Now it's my pleasure to welcome back to the show Michael Hastings. He is contributing editor at Rolling Stone. Of course, promoted to that position after his article last spring, or early last summer, in Rolling Stone, The Runaway General, the article that cost Stanley McChrystal his job as commander of the Afghan War. Welcome back to the show, Michael. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. Very happy to have you here. Happy New Decade.
Yeah, there you go.
For that matter. All right, now, you just got back from Afghanistan, I understand it.
Yeah, I just got back about 10 days ago now from Afghanistan. Spent a week down in Kandahar.
So it would be a reasonable assumption that General David Petraeus gave you complete access to him and his staff for a couple of weeks for this thing?
Yeah, I was unembedded on this trip.
I see. They did it different this time.
Yeah, I did put in an interview request, but the general was busy actually at this time.
I see. Preoccupied with other matters.
Yeah, apparently there's a war going on, and they didn't have time for Rolling Stone this time around. But we'll keep asking, and we'll see what plays out.
Right. Yeah. Well, I anticipate that you'll get the big exclusive next profile of Petraeus. I don't know why they wouldn't. Why he wouldn't. In fact, that would probably be his best option, right? Would be to somehow be forced out over what amounts to a minor embarrassment rather than having to admit defeat in Afghanistan.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I've interviewed literally dozens of generals over the years, and the only one who had a real issue, apparently, with watching what they were saying was General McChrystal. But yeah, I think my sense of what's going on now in Afghanistan is that General Petraeus is trying very hard to spin success. We saw that in President Obama's review, and it's pretty dicey. I think they have to be pretty careful about trying to oversell it.
All right, well, so give us some exclusives here. I bet you got a new piece coming out for Rolling Stone, but let's get it here first on Anti-War Radio.
Sure, yeah, I just sent my piece in yesterday to my editor, so waiting to hear back from him. But essentially, I'll give you the sort of, I can give you my kind of big picture take. I think what I plan to say in the piece and what the piece will likely say is okay, essentially this July 2011 date, that the White House has been sort of pushing for in terms of starting to withdraw, that date has just receded, and there's been a concerted effort among both the military and a lot of people also on the diplomatic side to get the focus off leaving in July 2011 and move that date to to 2014 and beyond. So I think that is sort of the next big debate that's going to come up is, how many soldiers are we going to withdraw this summer, and there's going to be a lot of resistance to withdrawing any significant amount, certainly in Kabul.
Now, is it your understanding that the White House is still pushing for 2011, or they're over it too?
I think there are factions within the White House who are still pushing for 2011, but, it's going to be a tough fight, and it's interesting, if you look at President Obama's recent comment during his review, he said, we're not doing nation building, which that's unclear to me how we're not doing nation building. But regardless, it seems to suggest that he's going to try to push, to get us out of there in 3 or 4 years rather than 10 years. And I think, the war is so unpopular now; it's reached its high in unpopularity. That maybe the Pentagon will have to concede and start to, bring troops home sooner than they'd really want to. And if that's the case, that means essentially cutting all sorts of deals with local warlords, militia leaders, this kind of thing, paying off who we can, killing who we can, and then getting out of town before anyone really notices the wake of destruction we've left behind.
Right. Well, that's sort of the Iraq model. Pretend that your surge worked by saying it over and over again, and then you can go, and yet it doesn't look like they're leaving there. And the timeline
right.
for that is supposedly written in stone.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing. It's the surge. I think that's the playbook, right? The playbook is Iraq. You say the surge worked, and you hope eventually violence starts to go down to a level that the American public doesn't really notice, which means American troops aren't getting killed. I mean, there was celebration today online in some of these foreign policy establishment places because only 3,000 Iraqis were killed last year in violence. And, you know, people were saying, you know, what a measure of success that was. I mean, that's like insane.
Yeah. It used to be 3,000 a month turning up on the side of the road with drill holes in their heads because Donald Rumsfeld's Bada Brigade had gotten a hold of it.
Yeah, no, that's true. So you know, and
it's hard work, but we're making progress, like George Bush used to always say.
No, and the difference is the challenge, I think, with Afghanistan is that as we've, you know, aimed our forces down south in Kandahar, the north and eastern parts of the country have become more unstable. And I think it was interesting, a group of academics and real Afghanistan experts put out a letter 2 weeks ago saying that, hey, you know, this isn't working. We need to start negotiating now rather than trying to find this military solution. Because no matter how often the military says there's no military solution to the problem, that's what they're going to go with. So yeah, I mean, I think I don't know if it's going to work like the surge worked, in the sense that you know, there's certainly no guarantee that violence is going to go down. You know, and if you don't have the violence go down, then they'll be in some trouble.
Right. Well, in Iraq, I guess they had the advantage of they were fighting a civil war on behalf of the majority that was going to win it anyway. So at some point, when the losers cried uncle, they could say, okay, well, let's, you know, we won't fight you if you won't fight us for now, when they really had no other choice at that point. But there's no majority to take the side of here. Doesn't seem
to. No, in fact, we're probably on the losing end of the civil war, really. I mean, if you look back at the fact that the Taliban, you know, had essentially won the civil war, we came in, knocked them out, and now they're back fighting this sort of same civil war again. You know, it's interesting, the notion of civil war in Afghanistan. A lot of the fears that Afghans have is that, in fact, we are setting the stage now for a future civil war. They don't necessarily, one can argue that they're in a civil war now, but a much worse civil war. And they say, you know, we're cutting deals with these sort of warlords. We're arming, you know, I don't know, whoever looks at Afghanistan and says, hey, what this country needs is more guns. But that's essentially what we're doing. We're looking for local militias to arm up to fight the Taliban. So essentially, we're laying the groundwork for what could be a significant increase in violence, at least in terms of Afghans. Now, if we get our troops out of the way, then it won't really matter in terms of affecting U.S. public opinion, as long as American soldiers aren't dying.
Mm-hmm. Well, in a way, it's like economic intervention, where, you know, if government, say, steers a bunch of capital into housing, then that makes houses seem artificially expensive for a while, and everything might seem great for the people who have a house that keeps getting more expensive, and they keep getting to refinance it and cash these giant checks and all this stuff. But then ultimately, the pain comes due, and it's sort of the same way here. If you're propping up, subsidizing and supporting and arming up certain groups of people in power, then what are they going to do when you're not there anymore? It's that fall very hard, like the people who were propped up in the South during Reconstruction after the American Civil War. When the Northern occupation of the South ended, there was hell to pay for the people who had been the puppets of the Northerners, you know?
Sure. Oh, yeah. And I think, I mean, it's really a question of you know, because you have these Afghans who will say, I mean, one of the media advisors to the mayor of Kandahar said to me, he said, look, if you guys are going to fight because you promised us democracy, you promised us human rights, you promised us civil rights, if you're going to be fighting for that, then you can stay. But if you're just fighting so you can arm, you know, drug lords and warlords, then get out now. And I think the answer is that's who we're fighting for, essentially. But yeah, as you said, it's this sort of inflates the whole process. And in a way, you know, by arming these other groups, you're sort of doing, I guess, a controlled burn, so to speak. You're just throwing more fuel on this fire in the hopes that it will burn out the conflict quicker. But that's certainly a risky game to be playing.
Yeah. Well, now, so this year has seen more than 495. I'm not sure exactly the number, but just the other day at iCasualties, it was 495 American soldiers, 700 NATO soldiers have been killed in the battle this year. And if you include last year with that, then these numbers absolutely put to shame the numbers from the Bush administration. There have been more deaths just in the last 2 years than in the entire Bush term, 9 years of 8 years of warfare under George Bush. And so, but the reason for that, though, they say in the press, they say in the president's review and their reports to Congress, is because, well, we're taking the fight to the enemy. And so, yes, that's resulting in more conflict, but still it's a measure of victory. We're paying a higher price, but the price will be worth it. So now you say you were in Kandahar. And Kandahar this year, along with, I guess, the test case kind of was Marja, but Kandahar was supposed to be, maybe it is, the showpiece of the counterinsurgency strategy. This is how you admit, if not defeat, admit that the previous strategies of the Bush administration weren't, quote-unquote, working. And this is the new way under McChrystal and then now under Petraeus, who, you know, McChrystal and Petraeus, of course, as everybody knows, were eye-to-eye on this whole coin concept and how to implement it and everything. So how goes Kandahar?
This is the big question. The week I was there was a slow week. There were only two targeted assassinations and one major bombing, which is, again, that's a measure of progress. Now, there's two big, big question marks, right? First is winter's coming, which is the fighting season, which means the fighting season has ended, so a lot of the Taliban guys go to ground. Secondly, the operations have had an impact, you know, from sources close to Taliban that I've spoken to. You know, you put 30,000 Americans. Yeah, they're gonna kick the hell out of a bunch of guys with AK-47s and bags of fertilizer. You know, we know that for a fact. But the question remains: is it sustainable? And will the Taliban be able to regenerate as they show they have done in the past? And the sort of final part of this question is: okay, great, we got the clear hold build strategy. Okay, maybe the clear part is working. We're not entirely sure, but, you know, maybe that's working. But is there going to be anyone to sort of transition to or any sort of local government in a box type deal we've set up with? And you'll talk to U.S. officials who'll probably say, you know, in a year, no, there's not going to be anything to transition to. Which is fairly startling, because, you know, we're spending all this resources fighting, But there's in the end of the day, there's going to be no legitimate government to take over. You know, I spoke to the mayor of Kandahar, who said that he had a staff of 74 that has been reduced in half, basically, because people are so afraid to get killed. Two of his deputy mayors were assassinated, and no Afghans really are still very much on the fence in terms of if they're going to sort of support the government. And fair enough, because they don't know, you know, the Afghan government's not exactly, they're not exactly well-liked, especially down south. So I will say that, you know, Kandahar, while I was there, was calmer than it was, certainly in the previous year, but everyone is holding their breath to see if that's something that's going to last until next year.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, the way I understand it, with the counterinsurgency strategy, as announced by Obama in his West Point speech a little more than a year ago, there was kind of this cognitive dissonance there, where they're basically implementing a strategy that, according to the strategy, if you read the manual, I think it basically, and really the writings of the guys at the Center for a New American Security and so forth, and they really talk about decades-long projects to clear hold and really build a new society the way you want to change entire societies, as John Nagel called it. And that is all kind of part and parcel of the counterinsurgency strategy, and yet they sold it as something that we're going to get accomplished in a year and a half, at least in a year and a half. It'll be good enough. It'll be implemented enough that we can go ahead and begin the process of leaving, whatever that means. But so I wonder if that just meant that they really meant they're staying for decades, but they had to throw something about we're leaving sometime soon in there, or if they really were intent on simply just fighting for another year and a half before beginning to leave in the Obama administration. Why didn't they tell Petraeus, forget the coin and just go with the Biden plan of the targeted assassinations only without the patrols, basically. More drones, more special forces, and apparently more raids and killings inside Pakistan, but not this whole clear hold build the government in a box kind of nonsense that is obviously doomed to failure.
Right, right. Well, this is, I think, the sort of tragic legacy of this policy. Maybe I'm speaking too early about it, but I think this is the got to the crux of the matter. Why? Because essentially, my read of it is we're going to have spent 2 years from Obama getting in office, 2 years to sort of fight to get to the kind of Biden plan. We're fighting to get to the Biden option. And you're right, we could have just transitioned, I believe, directly to the Biden option, which Vice President Biden wanted to do, but we didn't do that. Instead, because Obama got boxed in by the Pentagon, it had to triple the number of troops in Afghanistan. I think that was done for essentially political reasons. He had to be able to show that they did everything they could without, you know, because they didn't want to be accused of losing in Afghanistan. So essentially, the military wanted to do it. The White House was uncomfortable with it, but essentially went ahead with it at least for the next 2 years because they felt that they had to do that to show that they were, you know, willing to do everything to win the war. And then once that failed. Or at least, I mean, see, this is the whole thing, right? No matter if it fails or not, we're going to say it's a success. I mean, that's the reality of it, and we're going to go down to, as you said, back to the sort of targeted killings and special forces raids and arming up with local leaders. So that's the escape plan. The escape plan is to get to the Biden option. Why we had to spend $120 billion this year and 700 NATO lives to get there, as well as, you know, untold hundreds of Afghan lives, is a good question.
Hmm. Well, and you know, would you agree that the Biden plan basically, at least, you know, has implicit in it Pakistan?
Sure. And I think one of the conclusions of the strategy review last year, and as well as the strategy review this year, is that the problem is in Pakistan. You know, so if the problem is in Pakistan, the question is, why are we spending $120 billion a year and spending all this time in Helmand Province if actually the problem, quote unquote, is Pakistan? But just to get, I guess I didn't make this clear. I think there is tension between, are we really nation building and are we not? And, you know, the more Obama says we're not nation building, I think he believes that and doesn't think we're doing that. But then, as you said, if you look at all the strategy, if you look at all the plans, if you look at what the Pentagon wants to do, it's clearly nation building. So there is a dissonance there, and I think it's unclear to me, why they think we're not nation building when we clearly are, and that would lead to believe that there is going to be White House pressure to actually draw down. I mean. You know, essentially, in the speech President Obama gave last month, he said, we're there to kill Al-Qaeda. That's it. You know, and that's the Biden plan, right? We're there to go after Al-Qaeda and we're not going to try to, reform the women's rights movement and things like that.
Yeah. Well, but then the policy still is building massive bases and training, I don't know how many police and soldiers. Do you know?
Yeah. No, it's to me, and I said this in the story I did over the summer, but the most striking aspect to the entire policy debate is that we went into Afghanistan 10 years ago saying the one thing we're going to do is not get stuck in a quagmire. You know, 10 years later, we find ourselves getting into our second decade of war there. We find ourselves in the exact position that we didn't want to be in. And rather than backing away from that, we not only doubled down, we tripled down on the quagmire in a policy that every one of the principals, you know, read Bob Woodward's book, it has you know, the best reporting on this, but it's clear elsewhere as well. Every one of the principals has serious reservations about what we're doing there, and in fact knows it can't be won. But yet, you know, the momentum is there, and the political dynamics are such that the White House felt they needed to you know, wage this war.
Well, now when you're there, and I guess you got to talk to some military guys on the record or off.
Yeah.
Do they say that they're fighting Al Qaeda there?
No one is.
They're saying, "Come on, boys, arm up. We're going to fight Al Qaeda," right?
Yeah, never. I mean, that's the other kind of extraordinary thing in the disconnect. You know, you see, as you said, as you know, President Obama's speech is all about fighting Al Qaeda. But if you look at any of the literature or the press releases that come out of, or talk to any soldiers that come out of Afghanistan and Kabul, you know, Al Qaeda is not, it doesn't even factor in, right, at all. And you know,
yeah, we're mostly fighting the warlords that were our buddies back in the 1980s.
Yeah, we're fighting local guys who don't even know, you know, what September 11th was, but we're just here, and so they're fighting us. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, that's 99% of all the fighting. But yeah, I mean, we're not fighting Al Qaeda. We're fighting this. It's the same in Iraq. Most of the fighting in Iraq is not against Al Qaeda in Iraq. It was against this sort of local insurgency. So, you know, I even 2 years ago, I remember being on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border a couple years back with a unit, and an intelligence officer told me, he said, you know, hey, this isn't about bin Laden anymore, meaning this isn't about Al Qaeda. He said, you know, this isn't about Al Qaeda anymore. This is about cleaning up the mess. And that's what it's about. And you know, we can pretend back in Washington that we're fighting Al Qaeda by building schools in Helmand, but we're not, you know. And the arguments to say we are kind of loopy, like the CNAS crowd, Al Qaeda is always kind of tangential to this sort of counterinsurgency strategy, and you have to sort of jump through hoops to link the two. So much so that during the strategic review of, or one of them, I think it was last year's, there was a response from military officials and the political types who read it said, hey, you know, add a couple lines about Al Qaeda, you know, in your strategy. Remember, you know, so they certainly have to jump through hoops to sort of connect the dots there.
Well, now, do any of the people in Afghanistan have any idea or any theories, or do they even care or talk about at all where bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri are, or where they think they might be, and why it is that they don't ever even try to, say, for example, arrest or kill them?
Well, everyone in Afghanistan blames Pakistan for most of these things. But there was this extraordinary poll that just came out this past month from Kandahar that said 90% of adult males in Kandahar who were surveyed had no idea what September 11th was.
Right.
Which is pretty interesting. And so you'll get people, you know, get a lot of Afghans will say this to you, which is like, look, you know, Al-Qaeda's in Pakistan. Pakistan's funding the Taliban. Pakistan's preventing the peace talks. Pakistan could arrest a lot of these guys if they wanted to. In fact, when one Taliban leader living in Pakistan started having peace talks, Mohammad Baradar, the minute he started having peace talks without Pakistan's approval, Pakistan went and arrested him when they wanted to. So the Afghans will tell you, why is our country being used as a battleground when you know, it's the Pakistanis or the Iranians or whoever else who are funding these Al Qaeda guys.
Right, and if the Pakistani government are such close friends that they're willing to let us wage war in their country, how come we're backing their enemies in Afghanistan and helping the Indians make inroads with the Hazaras and Tajiks and Northern Alliance types that we've put in power in Kabul? It's pretty obvious, even in Washington, D.C., isn't it, why it is that the Pakistanis won't stop supporting the insurgency, the Pakistani government, I mean, won't stop supporting the insurgency in Afghanistan?
No, it's clear, and I think this is, again, back to the whole quagmire idea. You know, everyone knows that the Pakistanis aren't really ever going to change their calculation. or there certainly that seems to be the belief of people who know a heck of a lot more about Pakistan than I do, including the former ambassador to Pakistan. You know, the Pakistanis aren't going to change their calculation in terms of what they believe their strategic interests are. They're going to remain funding the Taliban because, as you said, their main enemy is India. Yeah, and they don't like it when we're supporting the Tajiks and the Northern Alliance types. So how do you sort of get out of that? This is the big question, and how do you get and I think the only way to do it, and this is, you know, going to what these experts said last week and what a number of think tanks are coming around to, is you need to start negotiating. You need to start serious negotiations.
Well, even there, we could, even if the Pakistanis don't like the Hazaras and the Tajiks and the Uzbeks in power in Kabul, we don't have to insist on Indian cooperation on the ground in that country and the use of their military and their intelligence agencies and whatever, and deliberately helping these groups ingratiate themselves with the Indian government. I mean, that seems to be, I can't see the use in it other than making sure that the Pakistanis continue to support the insurgency against that power in Afghanistan. If you're looking for sense, I can't think of another sensical reason behind it. Maybe there is one.
No, I think we're going to get outplayed. You know, we're going to get outmaneuvered there. Especially when in terms of who's supporting who and who's doing what. Yeah, I don't see how it helps us to anger Pakistan by supporting groups that oppose them, except that those groups happen to be the ones that we feel, you know, are somewhat our pillars of support in Afghanistan. One of the things that struck me and was said to me again and again, especially about Pashtuns and the insurgency in Afghanistan, is that, you know, the government and the Taliban are so intertwined in a lot of sort of really complex ways that you know, trying to defeat this sort of this Taliban insurgency by sheer force is going to fail, just because the ties between the different groups, especially down south, are so close. And often what gets spun is sort of Taliban, it's just criminal activity, it's drug dealers, it's warlords fighting. And that, again, I mean, that just hit home to me, as an Afghan contractor said, you know, about a number of the government officials, as he said, you know, they have one face, one of their faces to the government, the other face is to the Taliban. So in a weird way, we're sort of fighting ourselves. You know, even literally fighting ourselves, because a lot of our money ends up back in the hands of the insurgency. I'm so discouraged by the whole thing. I don't know if I ever want to go back, just because it just seems to be quite such a mess.
Well, you know, even beyond all those contradictory policies, even just the basic premise of taking the fight to the Taliban has its own problems in the sense of, you know, trying to dig yourself out of a hole, which I forget if it's Afghanistan, but somewhere I have literally seen Hillary Clinton say, when you're in a hole, you have to grab a shovel and get to work. Anyway, but there's this thing that you call it in your article, and I don't think there's exact quotes around this part of it, and I had a friend ask me about this, so I wanted to get your clarification. That's Stanley McChrystal, the former general there, who lost his job when your article came out, the runaway general there. You call it his insurgent math, and that insurgent math being, for everyone you kill, you get 10 more.
Right.
That's aside from, you know, backing Pakistan's enemies to make sure they back our enemies and whatever this madness going on. But, you know, and the people having to be two-faced and use their own weapons against us and all that. But just fighting the Taliban straight on, still the collateral damage there makes things worse. And I was wondering if you could clear up whether that's an exact quote from McChrystal. Did you hear that from him, or that's what his people say, or that kind of thing?
That's an exact quote, and that's one of the mantra of these counterinsurgencies.
He explained that to you. He said, "Michael, let me tell you about my insurgent math."
Yeah, and he would do that in a number of different venues. He would give presentations, and he would talk about insurgent math. And there's even a YouTube clip of him sort of explaining counterinsurgency, where he goes into the insurgent math. But it's something that he talked at great length about. Now General Petraeus has kind of abandoned that completely, or not completely, at least, you know, by upping airstrikes and things. But yeah, I mean, in the insurgent math, I mean, this gets to what I would call the sort of hoax of counterinsurgency, is they try to, you know, supporters will try to play it as this hearts and minds, warm and fuzzy thing, you know, oh, we're going to try to kill as few of them as possible. But at the end of the day, if you look how it's practiced, it's cold-blooded. It's about killing and capturing as many people as you can, and trying to get the natives to behave in the way you want them to behave. And you'll see how quickly they threw away the idea of insurgent math, which they basically did this year.
Well, I still kind of like it. Very much has that Orwellian Pentagon newspeak kind of thing, where all quality is gone and it only is a question of quantity, the kinds of things that can be measured in PowerPoints and statistics and body counts and, you know, dollars spent on a school here or there or whatever as a way to supposedly, you know, work it out like it's some chess game, like an actual math problem playing an IBM computer or whatever, rather than dealing with human beings, which is what we are talking about, killing them after all.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, oh, sure. And in that sense, the insurgent math, you know, I mean, that's just one of the, you know, war is peace, strength is ignorance, you know, slavery is freedom, you know, from break out the Orwell. Yeah, I mean, it's you know, for, and also, you know, another sort of twist to this sort of strange contradictions. We, you know, as I said, we've heard for years from counterinsurgents enthusiasts that you can't kill your way out of the war, and then you have all these press releases, especially in the last few months, basically bragging about how many people we're killing. So I you know, square that circle, and even in fact, one of these counterinsurgency guys from CNAS just went over there, and I saw a blog post he'd written where he basically said, you know, oh, we're killing a lot of Taliban. It's like, well, you know, I thought that wasn't, you know, that wasn't the point, right? But you know, people gravitate, institutions gravitate what they're good at, and the U.S. military is very good at killing people.
Yeah. Well, you know, Gareth Porter was talking about the collective punishment, the bulldozing of an entire village, I guess, on the outskirts of Kandahar. Did you know anything about that? Is that in your piece?
I heard complaints about property destruction. I haven't seen Gareth's piece. I'd like to. I definitely want to check it out. But yeah, part of you know, one of the main complaints that U.S. troops had this past year when McChrystal was there was that they weren't allowed to sort of bulldoze houses and abandoned houses and things like that, where Petraeus has taken the gloves off in that realm and has been you know, destroying more homes, launching more airstrikes and these kinds of things. But I didn't visit that village, no. But that would be, that's definitely something someone should go do.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's funny with all these, even the vast amount of daylight, it seems like, between McChrystal and Petraeus's way of handling this thing, it seems like one way to look at it would be just that they've failed over and over again. They keep changing their strategy. I mean, what is saying we're changing the strategy other than saying what we did before wasn't working? It's not accomplishing our goals, so now we got to do something else. But how many times do we have to admit defeat in a row before we just go? Because, I mean, they're not going to be able to – they're not going to stop being able to print money in America or whatever. They're going to be able to stay forever. They're not going to be forced out like, you know, the route at Saigon, you know, that kind of thing. So I guess they can stay, really, but – you know what I'm really interested in, though, is like the perspective of the, like, lieutenants and whatever, the guys in charge of the guys that go out on the missions and stuff like that. Like, what do they see about that? That book, The Good Soldiers by David Finkel, he talks about how Lieutenant General Kozlarich, he was there, he worshipped the coin manual. Look, everybody, the coin manual, this is so important. Line up and listen to me read it to you and all these kinds of things. And by the end of the thing, it was, oh, yeah, right, and it's covered in a layer of dust on the desk and nobody cares about that. We're just going out and kill people. And I wonder whether there's any kind of, you know, whether the Petraeus announcements and slogans from the top actually do trickle down, whether they continue to, whether they ever did. Do the people at the bottom take any of this seriously or what?
No, I've never. You occasionally on the ground level, you occasionally run into sort of the true believer types, typically kind of ambitious, you know, captains who are on the sort of officer career track. But any you know, talk to any platoon sergeant, any lieutenant platoon leader, you know, they kind of roll their eyes at counterinsurgency. I would actually recommend a colleague of mine, Matt Teague's piece in Men's Journal from this month, where he has a great scene where you know, one of Petraeus' representatives, this special forces guy, is kind of giving them talking to the troops about how great coin is. And literally, one of the medics blows cigar smoke in his face while he's giving this whole spiel about how great counterinsurgency is and how you have to be polite and drink more tea and all these things. I'm sure those things help to a certain degree, but that's not what it's really about. That's not what won in Iraq. It wasn't because we drank more tea with the mullahs. You know, it was because we supported Shiite regime that, you know, who was going to torture and kill their enemies without mercy, and we supported them fully. I mean, that's how we won that. I mean, won, quote unquote. But that's how they were even able to claim success. So yeah, I've never really met a lieutenant or anyone on the ground who was a real believer in counterinsurgency. That's my experience.
Well, so here we are. Wrapping up the decade, New Year's 2010, and this Afghanistan war is the longest war in American history. Got record numbers of deaths, no end in sight. As you say, Bob Woodward writes that every single person at the national security side of the cabinet, and including the president, have serious reservations about this whole thing. And we continue on, and yet it was a month ago. I guess I should have my footnote here, Michael. I'm sorry. I think it was Seton Hall or one of these universities through the Freedom of Information Act got a bunch of State Department documents from the beginning of the Bush administration leading up to the 9/11 attacks and after about their negotiations with the Taliban and how the Taliban had been trying to give up bin Laden the whole time up before 9/11 and then after it too. And all they wanted was to give them to a Muslim country, anyone. And of course, America controls all of them except Iran and Syria at that point. So, and Afghanistan itself. And so we really didn't have to have this war at all. They immediately kind of lied and conflated Al-Qaeda with the Taliban and pretended like the Taliban had attacked us, but he was a thorn in their side. They were, once a radical gets a government, he becomes conservative. It's like that.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to give up their power. And there's all the documents show it. You know, all these State Department documents show how badly the Taliban wanted to have a way to save face and at the same time get rid of this guy. And in fact, I had completely forgotten this, Michael. I don't know. I guess I just assumed at the beginning that they were all on board in ways. I figured out later the splits, and I had missed that from the very beginning. Colin Powell had said, "We have no interest in who rules Kabul. We're going after Osama bin Laden and them, and that's it." And that then he was immediately contradicted by Paul Wolfowitz, and then from then on by the rest of the administration. But Colin Powell initially said that he knew better than trying to take Kabul and rebuild the country. He wanted to go in there, get the bad guys with some bombs from the, you know, heavy bombers, and then retreat.
Yeah, and I think if we look at, the Taliban completely miscalculated. They should have given up bin Laden, and they should have not tried to. That was one time at the negotiating table where I don't think they realized just how much trouble they were going to be in. And then we missed, and then we continue to start missing opportunities in the next few years because a lot of these Taliban guys who are now fighting wanted to, especially on the Kandahar, wanted to negotiate with us and join the government. And instead, we kept on just, you know, keeping the pressure on and killing them. So talk about missed opportunities to have gotten us out of there way before this. But yeah, exactly. Colin Powell warned about it. I haven't seen those diplomatic cables, but it doesn't surprise me. You know, warned about getting stuck in the exact situation that we're stuck in.
Yep. Well, George Bush called it the first war of the 21st century, and I guess it's not going away anytime soon, Michael.
Well, if we're having this conversation in 10 years, then God help us all.
Oh, man. You know what? I don't think that's beyond, you know, anything less than probable, really, at this point, if not likely, right?
I could see our serious involvement in Afghanistan. By serious, I mean that it regularly makes the front pages of the newspaper for another 4 or 5 years. And anything after that, I think, again, to kind of how we are with Iraq now, which is it's sort of this afterthought that we've all kind of collectively forgotten.
Mm.
So, but yeah, I'll be happy to come on your show and talk about it if we're still there.
Right, yeah, in 10 years we'll reprise this and see, hey, remember the Afghan war? That turned out great.
Just keep saying it and it will come true.
The surge worked, everybody. The surge worked. We can come home now. The surge worked.
Yeah,
right.
the New Year's resolution is that we'll win it this year.
Right, there you go. And then we'll begin the end in July and call it a victory and reelect Obama in his all his glory.
It's going to be great. Job security for me, at least.
Yeah, obviously. Well, and for me, too, as long as I have you to interview. Thank you very much, Michael. Appreciate it.
Take care. Happy New Year's.
You too. Everybody, that's Michael Hastings, contributing editor at Rolling Stone magazine, author of the infamous The Runaway General article, which cost McChrystal his job, and also the book I Lost My Love in Baghdad. Look for his new exclusive in Rolling Stone magazine coming soon to a Quickie Mart shelf near you.